Our fourth case for this morning is Vance against Ball State University, 08-3568. Mr. Hershauer, or Ms. Hershauer, sorry.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Diamond Hershauer, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Ms. Mayetta Vance. Your Honors, this case is about a simple case of the person in authority, in this case, Ball State University in Indiana, not protecting its employee, Ms. Mayetta Vance, from racial harassment, a hostile work environment, and retaliation, and secondarily, the district court ruling in favor of the employer at the summary judgment stage. We present this case in three separate issues. The first issue is a motion to strike. The motion to strike was brought by the defendant in this particular case, Ball State University. After the summary judgment pleadings were submitted, Ms. Mayetta Vance presented additional information to the district court judge.
But before you get too far into that, Ms. Hershauer, it was long after the deadlines that the district court had established for the submission of evidence. And whether one thinks of this under the 15D model of supplemental pleadings or whether one just thinks of this as an ordinary motion to supplement the evidence for something that's already encompassed within the original pleadings doesn't strike me as all that important, because either way, the standard of review would be abuse of discretion. And it seems to me the district court was well within her discretion to think that this additional material, which is, you know, and powerful in a certain way, would disrupt the progress of the case at that point. The district court can just say this is too late, and I don't see how you can tell us that it was an abuse of her discretion to assess it that way.
Your Honor, our position is that, as you're absolutely correct in pointing out, it is an abuse of discretion standard. The discretion within the district court is to weigh the probative value of the evidence that is presented, in this case, additional information about Ms. Vance being called the N-word, Ms. Vance being threatened by her life, the university publishing derogatory remarks about her and other African-American employees and students on its websites, versus the cost that it would be to Ball State
University. The court obviously thought that there was a real cost. So if, for example, it had allowed the blogs and the material on the website, it would have opened up a whole new area of legal exploration for the university. This is a complex and actually evolving area, how one looks at defamation on the Internet. The district judge could have said, and I suspect she did say to herself, you know, this opens up a wedge into almost a whole new lawsuit. You know, and this lawsuit is about what happened. Now, the incident in the parking lot is, in a sense, more of the same. I mean, there's plenty of evidence of the use of very insulting language by various people. So again, I mean, if this were just something that the district judge, in the middle of the period of time established for discovery, had decided for some reason to keep out, you might have had a stronger case. But it's well after the deadlines.
And, Your Honor, the judge may very well have thought that she was going to open a Pandora's box. However, the purpose for this evidence, and it was made clear by Ms. Vance at the submission stage, was not to open a Pandora's box of new issues. It was only to establish and further clarify the issue as it related to her hostile work environment claim.
Ball State might have had a different response. They might have wanted to defend themselves in various ways, and this is a record where, on the question, which I actually think I'd like you to get to pretty quickly, the basis for employer liability, there's a pretty consistent pattern here of Ms. Vance complaining about inappropriate behavior and Ball State taking some action, whether it was enough action, you know, we can quibble about. But my guess is, given the way Ball State responded to things, is they might have had information that they would have liked to put in the record, and there the district court's deadlines would have gone out the window, and it seems to me tough. I mean, I recognize that this wouldn't be an issue if there weren't something in these materials, but district courts would never resolve cases if people could keep on throwing new things into the hopper.
Your Honor, and I do agree with you that at some point there has to be a deadline for submission of new evidence. And certainly, as the process goes on, the district court has every opportunity to weigh the probative value of the nature versus the cost. In this particular case, I believe that the district court should have permitted this evidence up to the point of the case actually going to trial because it was material.
How important is it to your case? Suppose you have to defend this, if what you're trying to do is convince us that summary judgment was wrong, is this evidence really all that important, or do you have enough without it?
Yes and yes, Your Honor. It is important in that it shows the fact that the steps taken by Ball State University were clearly not sufficient, since harassment continued and continued to such an extreme level. Ms. Vance continued to be subjected to a hostile work environment, even as the case was pending, even as summary judgment pleadings were pending. But, Your Honor, the second part of the yes is that even without it, we do think that we have sufficient evidence to establish a hostile work environment. And the reason for it brings me to the second point, is the racial harassment claim. As you well know, the issue is whether there was harassment, whether it was based on race, whether it was severe and pervasive, and
severe or pervasive.
Thank you, Your Honor. And whether there is employer liability. And on that issue as well, the additional evidence certainly speaks to that issue, but we do claim that Ms. Vance presented sufficient evidence of ongoing harassment from 2005, where she was hit by a supervisor.
Your main problem, though, is that most of it is not linked to race, or at least not overtly linked to race, so far as the record reflects.
Your Honor, we believe that obviously there's no question that the N-word is directly linked to race. But
most of the rest of the episodes that form the basis of the claim had nothing to do with race.
Your Honor, with all due respect, we disagree because we do think that ongoing statements of Ms. Vance being referred to as buckwheat, as Sambo, as porch monkey, are relating to her race. Her coworkers talking about members of their family being in the Ku Klux Klan and the fact that if Ms. Vance doesn't get out of there, you know, they will come after her. Certainly, her supervisor's daughter threatening to kick her quote-unquote ass because she is a N-word.
Those episodes relate to the coworker by the name of Nick Vicker, who was disciplined once these episodes were reported. The other coworker is Davis, and very little of that evidence relates to race.
Your Honor, the buckwheat and Sambo comments do relate to Ms. Davis,
right,
as well as she was actually the one who hit Ms. Vance previously and made threatening comments in an elevator, such as, I'll do it again, made comments in a southern accent to Ms. Vance, approached Ms. Vance and slammed a carton of milk next to her workstation. And I think a key point in this issue is that Ball State, when it did reprimand Ms. McVicker, only gave her a written reprimand. In a similar situation where a Caucasian employee was offended by the fact that another coworker used a homosexually derogatory term towards him, the coworker who used the term was fired. In Ms. Vance's case, despite numerous corroboration that the N-word was used by Ms. McVicker, Ms. McVicker only received a verbal reprimand. And that, I'm sorry, a written reprimand, and then continue to work alongside.
Step two of the progressive four-step system that was used?
Correct. And Your Honor makes an excellent point. In this particular case, Ball State had a zero-tolerance policy for sexual harassment. Zero tolerance. But for race harassment, it essentially said, do as you see fit. And in this particular case, essentially the harassers of Ms. Vance got a slap on the wrist, whereas Ms. Vance, the one instance where she slammed, I believe it was, chicken noodle soup, a pot of chicken noodle soup, next to Ms. Davis, with no corroboration whatsoever to that story, she gets written up, despite the fact that she had made numerous complaints against Ms. Davis, threatening her, lunging at her as she was trying to make a phone call to a supervisor to report an incident about Ms. Davis. Ms. Davis continued to work alongside her. This is a department that has 850 separate employees.
The only race-related incident of harassment involving the coworker Davis was the one that was not reported, right?
Your Honor, there were two elevator incidents with Ms. Davis, as well as the buckwheat and Sambo comments made by Ms. Davis.
But the latter were never reported. The overtly race-related comments were never reported, so the university wouldn't have been in a position to respond.
Correct. Your Honor, I believe that Ms. Vance never made a written complaint about it. However, she certainly complained to her direct supervisor, Bill Kimes. And in this particular situation, I think, once again, the system failed her because Mr. Kimes, by looking at Ms. Vance, essentially told her, grow up. What do you want us to do about it? It is the supervisor's responsibility, and according even to the rules and procedures set forth by Ball State, the direct responsibility of a supervisor to address the situation as they see fit. In this case, Ball State threw up its hands and said that we don't see any sort of remedy that we could make here.
So you're saying that she orally complained about the buckwheat and Sambo things to Mr. Kimes, and that oral complaints are adequate under the Ball State policy?
Your Honor, whether they're adequate under the Ball State policy, I would submit to be an issue for the jury. Additionally, Your Honor, there were a couple of issues herein.
Why is that a jury? I mean, why can't we look at the policy and see if it – I mean, a lot of policies are very comprehensive. Say, you know, complain to your supervisor, complain to HR, do this, do that. You know, would the policy help us at all?
Your Honor, I believe that the policy in this particular case, and certainly it's the appellant's position, was not adequate at all to prevent racial harassment or discrimination. I don't see any sort of an explanation by Ball State, and I can't comprehend a reason as to why there would be a zero-tolerance policy for one type of harassment, yet see as you see fit, do as you see fit type of policy for another type of harassment. There, in and of itself, by not promoting zero tolerance for racial harassment, saying that this type of harassment is not important enough for us to address. It's not important enough for us to address. And certainly there were a number of affidavits submitted by former employees that noted that there is that racially charged employment history at Ball State.
Ms. Vance was the only African-American in her little catering unit, which had how many people?
I believe her catering department, and I'm sure Mr. Shockley will correct me if I'm wrong, had a couple of dozen of employees. Mm-hmm. The overall dining services department under
right,
which the catering department
bigger.
Was
yeah.
was much, much bigger. And in this particular case, even Ball State admitted that there were a number of instances, such as the monkey term being used against Ms. Vance, for which Ms. Davis should have been reprimanded. The lunging, the threatening actions should have also been addressed by Ball State, but were not. And I see I'm out of my time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Shockley.
Please, the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Scott Shockley. I represent Ball State University and the individual defendants in this case. To follow up on counsel's, the court's question and counsel's response with respect to the employees in university banquet and catering, I believe the accurate number is approximately 60, but that includes part-time and student employees. There are actually somewhat fewer, I think, than two dozen or 24 full-time employees. It's somewhere closer to between 10 and 15. So the group of full-time employees, of which Ms. Vance became one in January of 2007, is somewhat between 10 and 12 or 15. And I had intended to point that out to the court because this case was exhaustively discovered throughout 2007 after the complaint was filed in late 2006. And I think every one of those 12 or 15 employees that had some knowledge of what, if anything, was going on in the workplace was either interviewed and affidavits obtained and submitted to Judge Parker, or they were deposed. And as I think the court's questions have indicated some awareness of, without exception, except the instance of Connie McVicker's use of the racial epithet to third parties, all of these witnesses indicated they were unaware of either a racial bias on the part of the supervisors, Mr. Kimes and Ms. Adkins in the department, and they were unaware of any racially hostile or racially improper events going on in the working environment. I think on that basis, Judge Parker quite correctly concluded that there was no basis for supervisor liability here.
Well, now, I guess the tricky question here is whether the steps that Ball State took in response to the complaints that properly reached it, I presume they were through Mr. Kimes or elsewhere, were in fact adequate steps. I mean, I guess Mr. Kimes counsels people, particularly Ms. McVicker, I'm not sure Ms. Davis, there's the written reprimand, but one gets the sense, reading Ms. Vance's brief anyway, that this highly offensive language continues to be used.
I don't believe there's anything in the record to support that. Mr. Kimes, immediately the same day upon the report in September 2005 by Ms. Vance that she had heard from third parties that Ms. McVicker was referring to her using the N-word and that she had members of family and clan and so forth, immediately commenced an investigation. And he interviewed everybody she said was a witness, and they confirmed it. He reported it up channels to employee relations and to university compliance, which is sort of the employment police on campus. And on the basis of that, they decided to impose not just the first step of discipline. McVicker, her use of language is deplorable, but amazingly enough, she didn't have any disciplinary history. So they struggled with what's the appropriate level of discipline for what is an aggravated form of language to use on a university campus or anywhere. But she has no disciplinary history. And there's actually, I think it's block quoted in Judge Barker's opinion, I believe it was an email from Melissa Rubracht, who was the associate director then of employee relations, saying we need to make a strong statement that this kind of behavior won't be tolerated or this kind of language won't be tolerated. And although we have a limited history of what we do with respect to violations of this profane language rule, let's impose a written reprimand and admonish her, and that's in fact what happened.
What are the real practical consequences of having a written reprimand on your record? It's not a salary consequence, I assume.
No, it's not. It's a step in progressive discipline.
Mm-hmm.
McVicker was a member of the union. Thus, if the decision hypothetically had been at that time, let's terminate her, undoubtedly there would have been a grievance because there was no history of this.
Yeah.
So it's a step in progressive discipline with the admonition that if you do this again, it may result in your termination that would make the determination to terminate her upon a subsequent event defensible in arbitration with the union.
And so do I understand correctly from everything that in circumstances where an investigation like the one Mr. Kimes undertook winds up with, as what he put it at one point, a he said, she said, or a she said, she said, at that point one does nothing, or is there anything else that happens when it's just difficult to nail down through some sort of third-party corroboration what really happened?
Well, Judge Wood, I don't know that there's honestly a clear answer to what happens. I think this case demonstrates that sometimes the decision is actually to make no decision, or at least to take no action, because things can't be corroborated. And we need to remember that with respect to several of Ms. Vance's complaints, there are actually counter or cross complaints by Ms. Davis, for instance. Different sides of what happened at the door to the elevator, for instance. Different sides of what kind of things, rude things, were said to each other. And I think Mr. Kimes, in the absence of any corroboration from a third party, felt like he couldn't determine who to discipline to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to university policy, there's no clear guidance on what a supervisor should do if, for instance, he cannot obtain corroboration of the employee's complaint. I think it's a case-by-case judgment.
It seems like that would be a relatively common occurrence, given the way these things come up. And I don't know whether one would counsel or whether one would, in some other fashion, reinforce Ms. Hershauer was calling zero tolerance. I mean, it sounds like from the email that's quoted in Judge Barker's opinion that the university, in fact, didn't tolerate racial harassment.
Right. I don't think it's fair to say they did. And zero tolerance is a phrase used with respect to the sexual harassment policy. That doesn't suggest that if it is sexual harassment, employee on employee, that discharge for the first offense is going to be what happens. We have to remember that this is a university campus and that policy applies across the board, not just among employees. It's not an ordinary working environment, but that policy has to be drafted in such a way to send a message to faculty about students and to students about other students. So it says zero tolerance, but it doesn't mean when it happens in the workplace between employees that it calls for discharge under the progressive discipline policy. or the union collective bargaining agreement. Sandra Davis is the plaintiff continues to maintain on appeal that Sandra Davis was a supervisor, and Judge Barker identified that, and the court has identified in your remarks, Judge Wood, at the start this morning, that employer liability is the issue you want us to get to. And Sandra Davis has continued, or the plaintiff has continued to maintain that Sandra Davis was a supervisor. But the evidence simply doesn't support that. As Judge Barker found in her opinion, Sandra Davis is a catering specialist. Plaintiff continues to maintain that this staff directory that's in the record, I think it's docket item 62-8, shows that she is a supervisor, and it doesn't show anything of the kind. It identifies three supervisors, Fordyce, Padrone, can't recall the name of the third one at the moment, but then it shows Sandra Davis simply by her title as a catering specialist. Her job description doesn't show that she possesses any of the kinds of requisites of authority that this court has traditionally required for someone to be a supervisor. She had no.
Right, and actually, once there have been complaints and a response, and on the assumption that there's no tangible employment action, I'm not sure that the difference is too big. Now, certainly with co-employee harassment, if there is no complaint, then the employer can't be held liable because the employer doesn't necessarily know about it in that instance. But Ms. Vance's situation is not one of failure to make complaints.
Well, actually, with Sandra Davis, it is. And there was a little bit of the dialogue between counsel for Ms. Vance and the court earlier. The only identifiable racially or conduct or words of a racial nature that Sandra Davis is alleged to have participated in is whether or not she referred to Ms. Vance as Sambo or Buckwheat, or at least said words to that effect to another party in the presence of Ms. Vance. As I think the court noted, there is no record of a report of that. And I think you have to read Ms. Vance's deposition, which is docket item 58, at about pages 50 to 55. That identification of that alleged comment actually seemed to occur as sort of an afterthought. It was in a period of her deposition when I was trying to exhaust Ms. Vance's identification for me of what things had happened that she thought were of a racial nature. And she says, and oh, by the way, Sandra said this about me a couple of years ago, and I just let it go. And she quite clearly said, I think a fair reading of her deposition is she quite clearly said, I didn't report it. And I showed her this comprehensive report she filed with the NAACP. It wasn't in there. If this happened, I deposed her in May of 2007. So if this happened in 2005, this is in the midst of all these complaints. Mm-hmm. And she's complaining about everything, about people being rude to her on the elevator. One would certainly expect her to have reported that. So I think there's really a question whether or not that was ever identified to Ball State in order for it to perform necessarily what it should have done to remedy that, just like it did with McVicker. Let me just turn to a couple other things in the time that remains. She has a couple of other points raised on appeal. One is whether or not there was retaliation against her. She claims that her job duties have changed. Ms. Vance, court would note, was actually in the midst of this litigation. 3 months after this complaint was filed, received a promotion, and a significant promotion.
From part-time to full-time, right?
And that's the significance of it is, as part-time employee, she's not a member of the bargaining unit. She doesn't have the protections of the bargaining unit. She doesn't have the protections of essentially full-time employment, which she received. She received about a $9,000 benefit package and a small raise. And so she received some job protection, which she didn't have as a part-time employee. Muncie is one of the aging industrial cities of the Midwest. Ball State has supplanted the old industrial plants and become the largest employer with excellent benefits. And obviously, the university is not going to close down and move across the ocean. These are good jobs, is the point I simply want to make. And this was a tremendous
benefit. Does the record show whether all people who become new full-time employees start out with salads? I mean, I'm trying to figure out the difference between her assignments and Mr. Hudson's, for example.
I think the record shows that she didn't start out with salads. I think the record shows, if you look at Chef Foltz's affidavit and all those prep sheets, and it's tedious to look through them, I think the record shows quite clearly that although there was some work like that, she did. She also prepared catered lunches. UBC is the part of the university that prepares the president's lunches, and it's partially why I think it's so tense there. There isn't zero tolerance for mistakes if you're fixing dinner for the president and her guests. But if you look at those prep sheets, the types of things both of them fixed are virtually identical. There are some what plaintiff has characterized as menial tasks, and there are some very complicated meals being prepared. So I don't think the record supports the contention that somehow, although it was a promotion in terms of compensation and other things, it was also a dramatic downward shift in her job responsibilities. She fancied herself and, by all reports, was an excellent baker. She wanted to continue to bake, but that really wasn't what this job that she and Brad Hudson were hired to do, both as catering assistants, required. They both did the same thing, and some of it was pretty complicated. So I don't think it supports that. I don't think there was adverse action with respect to that. She also maintains that she was denied overtime. Certainly there was a disparity. The record reflects between the overtime that she logged and what Mr. Hudson logged, and there's a simple explanation for that. She took a lot of leave during the, I think it was the 2007 calendar year. She took entire days of 70 days, and she was gone. And when she's gone, her work still needs to get done. It was given to Mr. Hudson, often requiring him to work over. My time's almost up. Unless the court has other questions, I thank you. Urge you to affirm Judge Barker's decision.
All right, thanks. Anything further, Mr. Schauer?
To address two key issues raised by my opposing counsel, beginning with retaliation, we clearly disagree. We do think that the job duties assigned to Ms. Vance and her quote-unquote promoted position were severely diminished from that was assigned to Mr. Brad Hudson. First of all, you have to understand that at this point, Ms. Vance had been employed by Ball State University for 17 years and had an impeccable employment record. As opposing counsel has pointed out, even her coworkers agreed that she was excellent in the job that she was doing. In her position as now full-time employee, Mr. Hudson was promoted on the same exact day, had not worked for Ball State University nearly as long, in fact, had quit working at Ball State twice, had come back twice, and now all of a sudden is being promoted. Their job assignments in terms of what the position requirements are identical. However, their actual jobs and the performance of them, not in theory, but in actual practice, diverge significantly. Mr. Brad Hudson actually was permitted to work in the president's dinners. Ms. Vance was a glorified salad girl. Her job was to cut up lettuce to make sure there's enough dressing at the salad bar. Mr. Brad Hudson was given opportunities to stay and work overtime, even on occasions when he and Ms. Vance were both employed, because the university does have this continuation policy. Once you start a job, you're there to continue it. Well, there's not much to do at a salad bar, so chances are Ms. Vance is not going to be given many opportunities to continue putting on salad as the dinner continues. Furthermore, it's almost a catch-22 type of argument. Yes, Ms. Vance did end up taking a lot of FMLA leave during the last year of employment because of anxiety and panic attacks, but those are precipitated by the fact that she was working side-by-side with her harassers. She took time off because of something that the university caused. And certainly other employees corroborate her testimony that Mr. Brad Hudson was given timesheets that actually were signing him up for overtime hours, and Ms. Vance was not given the same opportunity by Mr. Bill Kynes. The second issue that I wanted to address was regarding the issue of whether or not Ms. Davis is a supervisor. Certainly, she's listed as a supervisor by Ball State. Whether she has an additional title as a supervisor, I don't think is the key point. Mr. Bill Times even admitted that, yes, Ms. Davis was given assignments and was correcting Ms. Vance in her duties. She was a salaried employee, not an hourly employee. She didn't have to clock in and clock out like the other workers. And certainly she was perceived to be a supervisor by Ms. Vance, and that was never corrected by Mr. Bill Times. So all of the actions taken by her and certainly the representations made by Ball State indicate to us that she was a supervisory employee. Your Honor made an excellent point as to whether or not she was a supervisory employee. The harassment still continued, and we do still maintain that Ball State did not remedy it as it continued on. We therefore respectfully request this court to overturn the summary judgment and to remand this action for trial.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.